on one level, Vess knew the fading scream was his own. But his suffering was so intense that bizarre thoughts flared through his mind in a blaze of delirium. On another level, he believed that this eerie cry was not his own after all, but issued from the unborn twin of the service station clerk, which had left its image as a raw pink birthmark on the forehead of its brother. At the end, Vess was very afraid in the strangeness of the consuming fire. And then he was not a man anymore, but only an enduring darkness. Pulling Ariel with her, China backed farther from the fire, but at last she was unable to stand one moment longer. She sat on the highway, shaking uncontrollably, pain-racked, sick with relief. She began to cry, sobbing like a child, like an 8-year-old girl, loosing all of the tears never spent under beds or in mice-infested barn lofts or on lightning-scorched beaches. In time, headlights appeared in the distance. China watched as they approached, while beside her the girl mutely studied the moon. From her hospital bed, China gave detailed statements to the police, but none to the reporters who strove so arduously to reach her. From the cops, in a spirit of reciprocality, she learned a great many things about Edgler Vess and the extent of his crimes, although none of it explained him. Two things were of personal interest to her. First, Paul Templeton, Laura's father, had been visiting Oregon on a business trip weeks before Vess's assault on his family, when he had been stopped for speeding. The officer who wrote the citation was the young sheriff himself. It must have been on this occasion that the photographs had accidentally dropped out of Paul's wallet, as he had been hunting for his driver's license, giving Vess a chance to see Laura's striking face. Second, Ariel's complete name was Ariel Beth Delane. Until 1 year ago, she had lived with her parents and her 9-year-old brother in a quiet suburb of Sacramento, California. The mother and father had been shot in their beds. The boy had been tortured to death with the tools from a kit that Mrs. Delane had used in her doll-making hobby, and there was reason to believe that Ariel had been forced to watch before Vess had taken her away. Besides policemen, China saw numerous physicians. In addition to the necessary treatment for her physical injuries, she was more than once urged to discuss her experiences with a psychiatrist. The most persistent of these was a pleasant man named Dr. Kevin Lofglen, a boyish 50-year-old with a musical laugh and a nervous habit of pulling on his right earlobe until it was cherry red. "I don't need therapy," she told him, "because life is therapy." He didn't quite understand this, and he wanted her to tell him about her codependent relationship with her mother, though it hadn't been codependent for at least 10 years since she had walked out. He wanted to help her learn to cope with grief, but she told him, "I don't want to learn to cope with it, Doctor. I want to feel it." When he spoke of post-traumatic stress syndrome, she spoke of hope. When he spoke of self-fulfillment, she spoke of responsibility. When he spoke of mechanisms for improving self-esteem, she spoke of faith and trust. And after a while, he seemed to decide that he could do nothing for someone who was speaking a language so different from his own. The doctors and nurses were worried that she would be unable to sleep, but she slept soundly. They were certain that she would have nightmares, but she only dreamed of a cathedral forest where she was never alone and always safe. On April 11th, just 12 days after being admitted to the hospital, she was discharged, and when she went out the front doors, there were over 100 newspaper, radio, and television reporters waiting for her, including those from the sleazy tabloid shows that had sent her contracts by Federal Express, offering large sums to tell her story. She made her way through them without answering any of their shouted questions, but without being impolite. As she reached the taxi that was waiting for her, one of them pushed a microphone in her face and said inanely, "Miss Shepherd, what does it feel like to be such a famous hero?" She stopped then and turned and said, "I'm no hero. I'm just passing through like all of you, wondering why it has to be so hard, hoping I never have to hurt anyone again." Those close enough to hear what she said fell silent, but the others shrieked at her again. She got into the taxi and rode away. The Delane family had been heavily mortgaged and addicted to easy credit from Visa and MasterCard before Edgler Vess had freed them from their debts, so there was no estate to which Ariel was heir. Her paternal grandparents were alive but in poor health and with only limited financial resources. Even if there had been any relatives financially comfortable enough to assume the burden of raising a teenage girl with Ariel's singular problems, they would not have felt adequate to the task. The girl was made a ward of the court, remanded to the care of a psychiatric hospital operated by the state of California. No family member objected. Through that summer and autumn, China traveled weekly from San Francisco to Sacramento, petitioning the court to be declared Ariel Beth Delane's sole legal guardian, visiting the girl and working patiently, some claimed stubbornly, through the Byzantine legal and social services systems. Otherwise, they would have condemned the girl to a life in asylums that were called care facilities. Although China truly didn't see herself as a hero, many others did. The admiration with which certain influential people regarded her was at last the key that unlocked the bureaucratic heart and got her the permanent custody that she wanted. On a morning late in January, 10 months after she had freed the girl from the doll-guarded cellar, she drove out of Sacramento with Ariel beside her. They went home to the apartment in San Francisco. China never finished her master's degree in psychology, which she had been so close to earning. She continued her studies at the University of California at San Francisco, but she changed her major to literature. She had always liked to read, and though she didn't believe she possessed any writing talent, she thought she might enjoy being a book editor one day, working with writers. There was more truth in fiction than in science. She could also see herself as a teacher. If she spent the rest of her life waiting tables, that was all right as well, because she was good at it and found dignity in the labor. The following summer, while China was working the dinner shift, she and Ariel began spending many mornings and early afternoons at the beach. The girl liked to stare out at the bay from behind dark sunglasses, and sometimes she could be induced to stand at water's edge with the surf breaking around her ankles. One day in June, not realizing quite what she was doing, China used her index finger to write a word in the sand, peace. She stared at it for a moment, and to her surprise, she said to Ariel, "That's a word that can be made from the letters of my name." On the 1st of July, while Ariel sat on their blanket, gazing out at the sun-spangled water, China tried to read a newspaper, but every story distressed her. War, rape, murder, robbery, politicians spewing hatred from all ends of the political spectrum. She read a movie review full of vicious ipsa-dixit criticism of the director and screenwriter, questioning their very right to create, and then turned to a woman columnist's equally vitriolic attack on a novelist, none of it genuine criticism, merely venom. And she threw the paper in a trash can. Any more, such little hatreds and indirect assault seemed to her uncomfortably clear reflections of stronger homicidal impulses that infected the human spirit. Symbolic killings were different only in degree, not in kind, from genuine murder, and the sickness in the assailants' hearts was the same. There are no explanations for human evil, only excuses. Also in early July, she noticed a man of about 30 who came to the beach a few mornings a week with his 8-year-old son and a laptop computer on which he had worked in the deep shade of an umbrella. Eventually, they struck up a conversation. The father's name was Ned Barnes, and his boy was Jamie. Ned was a widower, and of all things, a freelance writer with several modestly successful novels to his credit. Jamie developed a crush on Ariel and brought her things that he found special. A handful of wildflowers, an interesting seashell, a picture of a comical-looking dog torn from a magazine, and put them beside her on the blanket without asking that she be mindful of them. On August 12th, China cooked a spaghetti and meatball dinner for the four of them at the apartment. Later, she and Ned played Go Fish and other games with Jamie, while Ariel sat staring placidly at her hands. Since the night in the motorhome, that terrible anguished expression and silent scream had not crossed the girl's face. She had also stopped hugging herself and rocking anxiously. Later in August, the four of them went to a movie together, and they continued to see one another at the beach, where they took up tenancy side by side. Their relationship was very relaxed, with no pressure or expectations. None of them wanted anything more than to be less alone. In September, just after Labor Day, when there would not be many more days warm enough to recommend the beach, Ned looked up from his laptop next door and said, "China." She was reading a novel and only replied, without taking her eyes off the page. He insisted, "Look. Look at Ariel." The girl wore cut-off blue jeans and a long-sleeve blouse, because the day was already a touch cool for sunbathing. She was barefoot at the edge of the water, surf breaking around her ankles, but she was not standing zombie-like and staring bayward as usual. Instead, her arms were stretched over her head, and she was waving her hands in the air while quietly dancing in place. "She loves the bay so," Ned said. China was unable to speak. "She loves life," he said. Choking on emotion, China prayed that it was true. The girl didn't dance long, and when later she returned to the blanket, her gaze was as far away as ever. By December of that year, more than 20 months after fleeing the house of Edgler Vess, Ariel was 18 years old, no longer a girl, but a lovely young woman. Frequently, however, she called for her mother and father in her sleep, for her brother, and her voice, the only time it was heard, was young, frail, and lost. Then on Christmas morning, among the gifts for Ariel, Ned, and Jamie that were stacked under the tree in the apartment living room, China was surprised to find a small package for herself. It had been wrapped with great care, though as if by a child with more enthusiasm than skill. Her name was printed in uneven block letters on a snowman gift tag. When she opened the box, a slip of blue paper lay within. On the paper were four words that appeared to have been set down with considerable effort, much hesitation, and lots of stops and starts. "I want to live." Heart pounding, tongue thick, she took both of the girl's hands. For a while she didn't know what to say, and she couldn't have said it if she had known. Finally, words came haltingly. This is the best gift I've ever had, honey. This is the best there could ever be. This is all I want, for you to try." She read the four words again through tears. "I want to live." China said, "But you don't know how to get back, do you?" The girl was very still. Then she blinked. Both of her hands tightened on China's hands. "There's a way," China assured her. The girl's hands gripped China's even tighter. "There's hope, baby. There's always hope. There's a way, and no one can ever find it alone. But we can find it together. We can find it together. You just have to believe." The girl could not make eye contact, but her hands continued to grip China's tightly. "I want to tell you a story about a redwood forest and something I saw there one night, and something I saw later, too, when I needed to see it. Maybe it won't mean as much to you, and maybe it wouldn't mean anything at all to other people, but it means the world to me, even if I don't fully understand it. I want to live." Over the next few years, the road back from the wildwood to the beauties and wonders of this world was not an easy one for Ariel. There were times of despair when she seemed to make no progress at all, or even slid backward. Eventually, however, a day came when they traveled with Ned and Jamie to that redwood grove. They walked through the ferns and the rhododendrons and the solemn shadows under the massive trees, and Ariel said, "Show me where." China led her by the hand to the very place and said, "Here." How scared China had been that night, risking so much for a girl she had never seen, scared less of Vess than of this new thing that she had found in herself, this reckless caring. And now she knows it is nothing that should have frightened her. It is the purpose for which we exist. This reckless caring.
Thank you. has been a Random House audiobooks presentation. We hope you have enjoyed this audio program. Other titles by Dean Kuntz, available on audio cassette from Random House, are Icebound, read by John Glover, and Dark Rivers of the Heart, read by Anthony Heald.